start that you want.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Matthew Blittner, and to my left is co-host Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is the one and only Outside the Studio. So, for the next 59 minutes, as always, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports takes. And we can get started with something that we hope doesn't jinx the red-hot New York Knicks. Dan, they've won four straight. It almost feels a little taboo to be talking about them winning so much because we all know that that can bring bad luck.
We saw some beautiful days of weather this week. We saw some sunshine, a lot of good temperature. And same with the New York Knicks. We saw a hot team playing well, playing extremely cohesively, and you gotta like what you see. Four in a row. Was it against the greatest four teams? Was it against four teams that were completely not hurt? No, but four wins in a row, that's something. Five wins in a row for the Knicks hasn't happened since 2014, so this is a huge streak that they're on.
Well, this whole season has been something that they haven't done in years. When was the last time they potentially made the playoffs? When was the last time they even finished 500 or better? This has been something 8-9 years in the making. They've gone through a lot of turmoil. They've had a number of different head coaches, a number of different roster turnovers. They've had a couple different GMs. This is something that Knicks fans, if the Garden was allowed to be packed out, and I do mean packed out in terms of 19,000 plus on a nightly basis, they would be, this would be feeling like the mid-90s. And it's not even close to the talent level, but it would be feeling like it was in mid-1990s again.
Well, it would be feeling electric, and it would be feeling like this is a team that's exciting to watch. This is a team that you see where the culture is good. You see them hustling on every play. You see the work ethic. There's that story that's been going around on social media about Julius Randle, where Kobe spoke with him when they were together on the Lakers and said, every time that I go to a new city, I make sure to work out there. And that Julius Randle and the rest of the Knicks have taken that type of Black Mamba mentality and brought that with them this year. This is a team on the rise. It's great to see.
That's a terrific Kobe Bryant story in regards to Julius Randle. And it reminds me of one other thing. If for those of you who watch or listen to regular radio or watch on their simulcast, the Michael Kay Show the other day was actually talking about how, in regards to the Knicks, there's not that star player who you're coming to watch as the box office draw. And it got me thinking, you know, they're right. People are not paying money to come see Julius Randle or to come see Emmanuel Quickley or RJ Barrett. Maybe in a few years, but right now, they are not doing that. They are paying to see this Knicks team because they are the quintessential definition of a team. Tom Thibodeau has made this franchise that has had so many issues over the last couple decades and made them into the quintessential team that the everyday Knicks fan or the everyday casual basketball fan can enjoy. And that's a major turning point.
And it's so interesting because the trend with basketball, we've all seen it, is the increase in offense, the increase in productivity on the offensive end. And this team is bucking that trend. None of their players are within the top 10 in any offensive category, not Julius Randle, not any of these guys. And again, offensively, the team statistics, none of them are within the top 10. What you're seeing is defensive effort and guys pitching in every night.
It's old school basketball, if you really want to think about it. In an era where games are being decided, you know, 120 points gets, you know, maybe gets you a win. I mean, for the most part, it should get you a win, 120 points. But we've seen games go past that barrier. The Knicks are really, you know, it's that 99 to 90 type of game.
Yeah, and the average is 104 a night, which sounds like a lot if you're used to old school basketball. But if you think about all the advances that have happened, giving up 104 points a night is quite an accomplishment. And it is leading the league in opponents' points per game. And what they're doing defensively is they're getting rebounds. They're actually fifth in defensive rebounds. Because one of the things that they're doing is they're not giving up those second chances as much. And that is part of the key. Part of the key is they're blocking shots. Part of the key is that they're playing into Tom Thibodeau's system. So a lot of excitement on the defensive end.
And that excitement currently has them sitting in the seventh seed in the East. Now, for those of you who have not followed this year in what the NBA is doing, the 1 through 6 seeds in the East and the West are guaranteed playoff spots. The 7, 8, 9, and 10 seeds are having a play-in, very similar to what they did last year in the bubble. So, if you are the 7 seed, you will face the 10, and the 8 will face the 9. The Knicks right now could potentially, they haven't done it yet, but they could make their move on this hot streak, cross that barrier from 7 into 6, and instead of having to worry about the play-in, could potentially get there. Again, there's a lot of potentially in this. They could make their way into a guaranteed playoff spot, which is what their ideal focus should be at this moment.
And there's another aspect to this as well, which is that if you're in the play-in round, as it happens this year, there's a clear top two. There's the Sixers, there's the Nets. So if you come out of that play-in round, where, by the way, you're not getting as much rest, you're working hard, you're playing, then you got to face those two teams. So then getting the sixth seed, where you're playing the three, makes a big difference. And really, it maybe can allow you to win a series or at least win some games in the first round. So it would be big if the Knicks could make that type of push.
And look, the Knicks very much right now are what the Nets were a year ago. They were a hardworking team, no stars to speak of, even if our guest co-host, Walt Bonet, liked to just text me saying how he thinks Taj Gibson is the box office draw. Sorry, Walt. Taj is not the box office draw. And, you know, for the Knicks, they don't have that thing. They are really following the Nets blueprint. Now, that's not to say that, you know, all of a sudden have a bid three next year in free agents, because I don't see any free agents coming up who are going to come and form that. But it's a starting foundation. I don't like doing a cross sports comparison, but it really comes to me that they're very similar to the 1996 Yankees. Who, yes, that team had a young Derek Jeter, a young Mariano Rivera. They had Paul O'Neill. None of these players were all-stars. Yes, they became all-stars and Hall of Famers and all-time greats. But in 1996, they were coming off their first playoff appearance in close to two decades. They did not have that true face of a franchise. They had a coach, in baseball, a manager, that really made them into a workman-like team in Joe Torre, and they were playing for an owner that most people don't like. The Yankees obviously was for George Steinbrenner, and the Knicks obviously for Jim Dolan. So the comparisons there are striking if you think about it.
That is a really interesting analogy, Matt. And what I will say also, obviously it's too early for that, but one of the other things is you're seeing the mix between the young guys and the older veterans. So guys who a lot of people had given up on. Alec Burks, not necessarily a big name that you would think about. Noel, even Julius Randle was somebody who had their career not go the way it could have been projected. And that mix of having the older guys and some of the young guys quickly, RJ Barrett, he's starting to develop. I know he frustrates Knicks fans sometimes, but he's got that potential. And again, you're seeing that, and that was similar to the way that the 96 Yankees were as well. And again, that comes back to coaching.
And of course, you didn't even mention Obi Toppin, who has been a lightning rod for, I don't want to say controversy, but he's been a lightning rod for Knicks disappointment, considering that he was drafted so highly and touted so much. But if he follows the RJ Barrett path, 2-3 years from now, could potentially be what Knicks fans thought he was going to and be a star. And the Knicks right now, they're going to be tipping off in probably, 3 hours, roughly?
About.
And they're playing the Mavericks tonight in Dallas. And it's ironic because the Mavericks are also the 7th seed, of course, out in the West. And Mavericks owner Mark Cuban, he made some, I'll call controversial comments the other day. Dan, Cato and Leiden, everyone.
And of course, he made the comments about the play-in round and saying that the NBA shouldn't go this way. And it was pretty hypocritical. It was obviously, I mean, Mark Cuban is a flamboyant character, but he's not somebody that we should take too serious. I think that the play-in round is pretty exciting. But in terms of the Knicks' five-game win streak, I think
four. Don't jinx them.
No. I'm saying in terms of the five game
win streak. We believe in jinxes here.
I'm saying in terms of the potential for a five-game win streak. I know I hate to do this. I hate to do a prediction without a Nostradamus Walt Bonet. I don't think they end up doing it. I think they don't match up well against the Mavericks. But it's been a nice while it lasted.
Well, we will see, and you know, hopefully the Knicks can keep it going. Get out the rabbit's feet, get out the four-leaf clovers, get out the lucky underwear, and whatever else you might need, because the Knicks need to keep this going. Changing course, though, we're going to get into our first interview, our only interview for the day, where we're going to recap the NHL trade deadline and really focus on a lot of what's going on in the NHL right now with the sporting news of Jackie Speidel. I'm going to go get Jackie while Dan vamps about whatever it is he vamps about while I get our guests.
Jackie Speidel, I'm actually extremely excited that she's on the show. I guess that's what I'll vamp about in the time that Matt is out. And she's somebody who writes for Sporting News. She's somebody who has a real inside on the NHL right now. And there's a lot of interest from the New York teams. I mean, obviously, the Islanders are continuing to make a push. They made a big deal that we discussed last week. And the Rangers, you know, the Rangers, maybe there's something happening. Maybe they're coming together. Some of these young guys are coming up. Perhaps there's something there. Even though they stood pat at the deadline, which I think made a lot of sense, and we'll break down with Jackie, it's really good timing for her. We'll really get into all the stuff with the trading deadline and also with a big story that actually she's working on that we'll get into that with her.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're back, and we're joined by the Sporting News' Jackie Speidel. Jackie, it's Matt and Dan with Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. And Jackie, you know, just this past Monday was the NHL's annual trade deadline. Of course, the Islanders and Devils were pretty busy. Rangers, not so much. So let's get started with the Islanders. They made the trade for Kyle Palmieri and Travis Zajac, which, yep, of course, they got from the Devils. They made a smaller move for Braden Coburn to shore up the defense. But the big story, or that a lot of people are maybe overlooking, is the fact that Taylor Hall was very, very close to becoming a New York Islander. And what are your thoughts? Did the Islanders make the right move in backtracking from Taylor Hall and instead choosing Palmieri and Zajac?
Well, I think when you look at Taylor Hall, you obviously call into question a lot of what's gone on in the last couple of years, inconsistencies. You know, it sounded like he really, his only choice was really to go to Boston. So the fact that the Islanders were even mentioned is kind of a big deal. But I do think they really went the right way with getting Palmieri and Travis Zajac. They know them as players because they've obviously, especially this year, right? You know, they've played them a number of times. But, you know, those guys have been Devils for a long amount of time. So they know them very well. They're both quality guys, quality players, at different elements. Obviously, Travis Zajac brings a very defensive-minded forward game. It's a good move for the Islanders, and I do agree also that, you know, adding Braden Coburn was a good move as well in terms of as a depth defenseman.
And in terms of the other side of that deal, the New Jersey Devils, mm-hmm, they're in a situation where they were very much sellers at the deadline, and
right,
they gave up a lot. Do you feel that they got enough back in the multiple deals, not just the Palmieri deal, but in their other deals around the deadline?
Well, I mean, they got a first rounder, right? They got a first rounder in that deal with Palmieri and Zajac, which Taylor Hall did not get for the Sabres. So that right there, you know, that's a big move for Tom Fitzgerald. You know, I've actually been impressed with Tom Fitzgerald since last year when he was the interim GM. He really does get a lot back in terms of these deals. You know, the Devils were sellers last year also at the deadline, and he made a lot of big moves then too. And to get something for Dmitry Kubalik in terms of a pick when, you know, he was probably going to walk at the end of the year because he's an unrestricted free agent. You know, Tom Fitzgerald does a remarkable job. and he should be commended.
He very much does, and, you know, I know a lot of people were a little curious as to what he would do when he took over for Ray Shiro, but he certainly very much filled Shiro's shoes and then some. And
yes.
You mentioned Kulatov. There's one other player who left the Devils. It wasn't via trade. It was via waivers, but it's still part of that whole, you know, weeding out the players that they don't want on the roster anymore process, and that's Gusev. And, mm-hmm. you know, why didn't that work out for the Devils? It seemed like there was so much hype around him a couple years ago. So why? And look, they had to do it. But why did he not work in New Jersey?
That's a really good question. And I'm not sure we're ever going to know the exact reasons of what transpired in regards to him. However, you have to remember he came over after a number of years in Russia and playing, on a big rink. And there are a lot of differences with playing on an international size rink versus playing on an NHL size rink. There's so much more space out there. There's so much more ability to move. And when you're a guy like Gusev who has a high level of skill, having more space gives you the ability to really showcase that. And then when you're on an NHL rink and you're on a smaller surface where all of a sudden guys are way quicker to get on you, there's a really big difference. So I think he struggled a little bit last year coming out of the gate with that. And then maybe just last year feels like 1,000 years ago, right?
But oh, absolutely.
I just feel like maybe he never got his footing last year. He was bounced around the lineup a little bit. I remember he was playing with Jack Hughes for a little bit. He was playing with Taylor Hall, Palmieri, but that was last year. But still, I just feel like maybe not having the footing last year kind of led into this year a little bit. It'll be interesting to see how he does in Florida with the new team. He does have skill. We know that, right? He's definitely proven that. The question is, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. It happens. It happens to even like the greatest players, you know. Not everyone's going to fit where they go.
No, and that makes a lot of sense. And really rounding out the tri-state area in terms of the deadline moves, the Rangers, in this case, they were the big story was that there wasn't a story. They more right. or less stood pat at the deadline. Does that, we were calling on the show that made some degree of sense. Do you think that there right. was a move that they could have made that they didn't go for or that would have made sense?
Well, I mean, the only thing left for them to do is to get rid of Tony D'Angelo, right? To move that contract away. There was
good luck with that.
Yeah, well, there was a rumor. I don't recall which insider said it off the top of my head, but there was a rumor that the Canadians were interested if he was in fact placed on unconditional waivers for to get released. But supposedly Tony D'Angelo reneged on that. He didn't want to be released. Not really sure why, but. That's his call, obviously. But yeah, I mean, like, in all honesty, the Rangers have goaltending. They have a strong defense with, Adam Fox and Truba and the rest of the guys. They have a solid forward group. They probably didn't need to make a move, in all honesty. I mean, maybe an extra forward who can score like a high scoring forward, but you're not going to get that. And you're not going to get that probably with the prospects that the Rangers have right now either.
Well,
that would have been a blockbuster move, and I don't think they had the ability to make that.
They also probably don't have the cap space in this flat cap era.
That too, yeah.
But so we'll have to wait and see for the offseason. One thing, though, is the Rangers and the Devils, they're two teams, the Islanders we've already addressed, they're in win-now mode. The Rangers and Devils are in two different stages of their respective rebuilds. I know the Rangers have moved away from the word rebuild over the last several months, but until they start buying, I'm going to continue that. It's a rebuild for them. And this is Hudson River rivalry week. The Rangers are in the midst of a four-game baseball-like series with the Devils. And it really has been one-sided, which is shocking in a way. So what's your take on where these two teams stand right now?
I mean, the Rangers are pushing for the playoffs. They're not that far behind the Bruins. The Bruins obviously struggled. Well, what was it, like 8-1 they lost to the Capitals, and then the next, later that night they get, or the next morning they get Taylor Hall. I mean, the Bruins are struggling. They needed secondary scoring, so that's why they went out and get Taylor Hall. I think for the Rangers, I mean, this team has been playing really well. And you have to remember, this is a short season, right? And it's a very compact season. So it might take teams like the Rangers are now playing very well, took them time to get to this point. They're in the fight for the playoffs. They're not far behind. They're only, 4 points out of the playoff spot?
Yeah, 4 points, but the Bruins with two games in hand.
Right. So obviously those two games in hand are pretty big for the Bruins right now. I don't know what, off the top of my head, I don't know the makeup of, you know, do the Bruins play the Capitals for five more games? Do they play the Islanders for five? You know, so obviously those two games in hand, they have like a certain leeway to them, if you know what I mean. It'll be interesting to see. I do think, you know, look, the range, you know, the Devils, we are in a rebuild. We've known that for a while now. They're making headway. They're playing good hockey. Mackenzie Blackwood is a very good goaltender. I actually had him fourth last year or fifth last year in my Calder Trophy balloting. He's a very good goaltender. He will be a rock in the net for the Devils for years to come. But they don't need to win every game right now. Like, that's not expected from them. The Rangers, probably a little bit more expectation with how things are going, especially after last year. We don't know what the Rangers would have done last year if the season had continued and played as normal. I personally thought that there was a good chance that they would make a charge for the playoffs last year, and they're doing that this year. So we'll see what happens. It's two very different teams going two different directions a little bit, right? Like, the Devils aren't necessarily going completely down, but there's no need for them to go, like, skyrocketing up right now.
And
if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And something that you've talked about also that you're writing a big story mm-hmm. on that we're very excited about is Patrick Marleau and the unbelievable accomplishment that he is about to do. He has played 1,765 NHL games. It's too short of Gordie Howe's record. And he's set to pass that next week. This is somebody who played every season, almost every single game. You look at his stat sheets, it's 82 games. Even in years, I was actually speaking with Matt before the show, even in years where it looks like he's played less games, those were just lockout years. He's played every game, every season. What is the key to his longevity?
If you ask him and I've spoken to a couple of his ex-teammates, they say good genes, good genetics from his parents, in all honesty. I don't know how Patrick Marleau does it, to be honest. Patrick and I are the same age. I'm a month older than him, literally. And I don't know. I get out of bed every day and my bones hurt. So I don't know how he goes out and laces them up and plays NHL games like he does. It's quite a marvel to see. He doesn't even really know. He credits a lot to his trainers. He credits a lot to the coaching staff and masseuses and athletic trainers and people who've helped train him in the off seasons. He does something with ice baths to help calm the body down. But in all honesty, I mean, it's remarkable what he's doing. I mean, 42 years old and doing what he's doing is remarkable. He's going to break it on Monday. So in Vegas, and there will be fans in attendance because the Vegas Golden Knights do allow some fans into the building. So that'll be at least, you know, a nice thing to have some people in the building.
It's almost a shame that it won't be taking place in his home arena.
Yeah.
Even with the reduced amount of fans, just, you know, to have them in attendance. I mean, look, there's already been that rivalry the last few years between, you know, out in the West there with San Jose, but you almost feel that, you know, maybe, you know, you can't say, okay, well, the lead should change the schedule. But in this year where the schedule gets changed seemingly daily with the amount of games affected by COVID and whatnot, I think they could have potentially made an exception for this one. So
I think it was supposed to be in San Jose, and because of if it had timed out right. But I think because there was a change to their schedule, it actually ended up being this Vegas game. But his family is going to be there. He said his family wants to be there. They're going to be there. They're going to be in the building to see it happen. So I think that's a really nice thing for him.
That will, of course, be very nice. Hopefully they bring them out on the ice in some way to acknowledge them. The last question I want to ask you, and ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Jackie Spiegel from the Sporting News. And it's in regards to Marleau. the what is his legacy in your view? What is his legacy as a National Hockey League player? You know, you think of some people, you think championship, you think of some goalies, you think, you know, the amount of Vezinas they've won or the fights they've got into if you happen to be Patrick Roy. What is Marlowe's legacy?
Well, I think this is it. I think durability. I mean, look, I've talked to a number of people on Patrick Marlowe, and not a single person has said a bad word about him. He's a remarkable human being from what I've gathered talking to people that know him. Everyone spoke glowingly about him. And that says something about who he was. I mean, he was an 18-year-old kid that when he came into the league, just got drafted number 2 overall. But he's just a good kid. He's a good human being, it seems like, from what everyone says. And I think that's a testament to him, and obviously a testament to his parents. His legacy, he just wants people to know that he was a good hockey player kind of deal. And I think, look, this record is his legacy, if you think about it. Unfortunately, there's a good chance he won't win a Stanley Cup in his career at this point.
Which is a shame.
Sorry?
Which is a shame that he won't win a Stanley Cup.
It is, but there's been a lot of really amazing players that have not won Stanley Cups. Mike Gartner did not win a Stanley Cup. So it is what it is, I guess. But this is his legacy here. I mean, also everyone I spoke to just right away was like, I never thought this record would be broken. They always said this Gordie Howe record would never be broken.
Well, records are made to be broken, as they say.
Well, I mean, it's crazy when you think about it. I mean, he dealt with lockouts, multiple lockouts, and shortened seasons. And to still, obviously, he's played 82-game schedules, which Gordie didn't really do, especially, you know, I would say the entirety of his career. So that changes things a little bit. But it's remarkable. It really is to play this many games in your life. I mean, and Joe Thornton and him were both drafted the same year, 1-2 kind of deal. Joe Thornton's at least 100 and something games behind him. And that says something, right? So they're outside of Zdeno Chara, they're some of the oldest players in the league. So it's remarkable. It really is. I give him a lot of credit.
I'm right there with you on it. And, you know, Jackie, thank you so much for joining us here. And we look forward to seeing that feature on Patty Marlowe when, you know, he does break the record. Ladies and gentlemen, make sure that you do tune into that game Monday night, because it may not be as glamorous as Gretzky breaking Howe's goal record, but it's still a very, very deserving highlight.
Well, it says something real quick. Just the last couple of games he's played, guys have come up to him afterwards on the ice. I believe it was against LA, and Jeff Carter came up to him. I mean, that just shows you also who the person that Patrick Marlowe is.
Absolutely. So. And Jackie, again, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Fans, please go out and, you know, look at Jackie's work on Sporting News, and you won't be disappointed.
I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye, Jackie.
Bye.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, again, that was Jackie Spiegel of the Sporting News. So that concludes our hockey take for today. As much as you know that we love hockey here on the show, we're going to now move into baseball. Of course, baseball is 162-game season, and that would make it interesting for 162 games a year. And maybe they might not all be interesting, but that's our job here on radio to do the impossible. So let's get started with the New York Mets, who still cannot score for Jacob DeGrom. I feel like a broken record. Everybody feels like a broken record because DeGrom, he may as well just, if they put him in the lineup 1-9, if they made a special rule to make it where he could bat in all 9 spots in the lineup on days that he pitches, there's a better chance that he would win games.
There's actually a really interesting article that Tom Verducci wrote about a week ago about Jacob DeGrom, because the narrative is the Mets don't score runs for him. And
I mean, have you watched them? They don't.
it's a feeling, but actually, if you go through the numbers, it's a little bit worse than average, but it's not so hard on his luck. Actually, it's just slightly above league average. One of the things about Jacob DeGrom is that people notice it because he pitches so well so often. So when you don't give him good run support, it feels more traumatic than the actual numbers will show that it is. But regardless of whether he actually gets as much run support. He's somebody who, in games where his team scores two runs or fewer, has the third best ERA in the last 5 years. And the other guys on the list, or the last 10 years, and the other guys on the list are Clayton Kershaw and Max Scherzer. Jacob DeGrom has pitched unbelievably, and the Mets, they need to support him. They need to make sure that those starts go to good cause.
Look, they're doing themselves no favors. I mean, Major League Baseball is doing themselves no favors. The Mets are now in Denver trying to don't play the Rockies. And, I mean, we all, if you've paid attention to social media, they literally flew into a blizzard. So, in a stadium where the ball generally flies out and pitchers get hammered, I can only imagine trying to play through a blizzard. It just won't work.
I don't know how this is going to go. I mean, also, the Mets have had so many games canceled this year because of COVID. Yesterday, it was raining as if we were in a hurricane. So I don't know how the MLB is going to get this back on schedule. I guess it's just doubleheaders. I guess that's the answer, is just they're going to play a bunch of, like...
Start to draw on both ends of the doubleheader. And maybe he lucks into some run support at some point. To go back to the old 1900s adage in that.
But again, the Mets have played well, and the pitching has been good. This is the story that we talked about the Mets, was the starting rotation has been good.
It's going to get better once Syndergaard and company come back from injury.
But even for now, it's been very good. Guys like Walker pitched well. We saw him pitch well. We've seen Stroman pitched well. We've seen the Mets actually really not give up very many runs, and that's going to be key if they want to continue to be a good team this year.
And look, the Mets, everyone talked about how the offense was one of the best in the National League. And look, Dom Smith is doing very, very well. But some of the big guns, they need to step it up. Jeff McNeil, as my co-host Dan has told me off the air, has just been eh. And Pete Alonso has been meh. So I'm not quite sure that the two of them are really pulling their weight right here, right now. And if the Mets are going to make any noise this year, I know, you know, right now in April, you can't really look at the standings because no one's played the same number of games between COVID and weather and days off. Just doesn't work out that way. But you've got to somehow find a way to, if the Mets are going to make noise and if they're going to make the playoffs and go far, they're going to need McNeil and Alonso to join Dom Smith and Brandon Nimmo, as well as the rest of the lineup, in contributing. Because you can't win with just two guys batting.
No, but again, this is April. I'm not setting out the alarms yet. Brandon Nimmo has played really well. I don't think he'll maintain a .483 batting average. I don't think he's the next one to do that. But I
that
do,
would put him at the highest batting average ever. So yeah, he yeah. most certainly won't.
But it's good to see him swinging well. Even McNeil has had some good cuts, even though they haven't necessarily worked out. But again, the offense will need to pick up, especially if this team wants to be a contender, which it thinks it is. And it's going to be interesting because they have a lot of games coming up. They're going to have a lot of doubleheaders, a lot of maybe you know, putting some stress on that bullpen because all these games have been canceled. It'll be tough. So the offense will definitely have to pull its weight.
Well, God only knows that Mets fans are terrified of you using the B word right then. I do mean the word bullpen, because they've seen what this team has gone through over the last few years. And the less bullpen, the better, the less chances for them to potentially screw up. Although, who knows? Bullpens are volatile. One year you're good, next year you're bad. Or one year you're bad, next year you're good. So who knows? In the meantime, though, a team that is, and I say this painfully, they are struggling. They are under 500. I know we don't pay attention to records in April, but there's something wrong with the New York Yankees. And it's, look, I know it's a tradition that fans will call for the manager's head. It's part of being a fan in sports. So I'm not even gonna. I've said it on the show multiple times about how I don't think Aaron Boone's a good manager. We get all that, but the fact that the fans and the writers, okay, NJ.com even, is calling for Brian Cashman's head on a silver platter right now. That is telling that everyone is fed up with, look, Cashman, he made his bones off of the dynasty in the late 90s, early 2000s. He, of course, a lot of that was put in place by Gene Stickmichael and by Bob Watson. Of course, Cashman did some great stuff during that time. Not going to take away what he's done. He's had one championship in the 20 years since. And most GMs, actually all GMs outside of Brian Cashman, would not have been kept at some point after during this 20-year stretch of only one championship. That is not good. And Cashman, I know Steinbrenner family wants to, you know, Hal wants to have these budgets in place and be more financially responsible. I get all that, and good for him. But Cashman's been bargain basement hunting. And I know there's some hope that Kluber and Tyone could be something. They could have had Rodon for cheaper. And Rodon just threw a no-hitter.
And what you're seeing is what was the worry about the Yankees. The worry wasn't the Yankees don't score enough runs.
I mean, they're not scoring this year.
They're not scoring enough runs, but that wasn't the concern. The big concern was, does this rotation hold up? Does this rotation, where they did do some bargain hunting, and they did get guys who are maybe on the back nine of their careers, like Kluber, or guys who have histories of injuries and are inconsistent, like Tyone. And the question is, would this be able to hold it together? And so far, the rotation has not pitched well outside of Gerrit Cole.
It almost reminds me of the old of the Braves' old adage, the Brewers, with spawn and sun and pray for rain, because you might want to have Cole pray for a hurricane, Cole again pray for another hurricane, and so forth, because that might be the only way the Yankees are able to survive this from their pitching standpoint. The bullpen has been actually decent right now. You know, they're not quite whole yet. Zach Britton's not bat. The lineup, I don't know what's going on. DJ LeMahieu has been, look, you can't keep going with what he's done the last 2 years. His track record says he's a great hitter, but maybe not that great as what he's done the past two seasons. So hopefully he can correct himself. Clint Frazier lost his starting job already because of two bad games. And Aaron Boone's already backtracking on his initial statements. Aaron Hicks isn't doing well. Gleyber Torres defensively is making it seem like, why did they invest in him in this? Again, it's only April, and you cannot overreact to things. But that's what Sports Talk Radio is, overreacting to negatives or positives if they happen to be very good. And the Yankees don't really seem to have any positives right now, and it's eating away at me. I know Dan's secretly,
excited.
Forget the secretly, he's openly excited about it. But this is a painful thing, and you have to hope that the Yankees can course correct at some point. I just don't see it.
You don't see it? You don't see them course correcting? Wait. Let's backtrack. I know we're on Sports Talk Radio, and I know we like to get very excited about things. But at the end of the day, by the way, this was my team to lose in the World Series, so I'm defending a little bit. I'm defending my pride and my honor as the next Nostradamus of the group.
Oh, this, Lord, I've got two Nostradamuses to deal with now.
This lineup is still stacked at the end of the day. This bullpen is still good. This is still going to be a team that's really competitive. Now, they need to get their heads together, because, again, the games in April count as much. It's still one win in April and one win in September. But to say they're not going to correct the course, Matt, come on.
Look, if Joe Torre always said you can't just flip the switch come October, it doesn't work that way. And going back to last season, which, again, was just a complete aberration, complete abnormality in how things went, a 60-game season, just so many things went right and wrong throughout baseball, but the Yankees were a 500 team, if not worse, last year at most points. Okay, they did not perform well. This is not a new thing of the Yankees just underperforming for 12 games or so right now. They didn't perform well last year, and again, there comes a caveat of it was a weird season last year. I get it, but this is no longer just a two-week slump. This is something where the Yankees, it probably is not the core that needs to be done. The 1980s decade, the Yankees finished the decade from 1980 to 1989 with the most regular season wins in the entire major leagues. Okay, think about that. They had more collective wins than every other team. You know how many times they went to the playoffs? 1980? 1981, that's it. How many times did they win the World Series? None. That is telling. The Yankees are doing the same thing this past thing. And I know decades are not, you know, you don't start in the middle, but in a 10-year stretch, so if you want to start, let's say, 2015, 2016, going onwards, we're 6 years into this now. in terms of having most of this tour in place. And what have they done? Yeah, they've won 100-plus games a few times. They might even win 100 games again this year. But do you really see them getting through the grueling grind that is the playoffs? Because I don't see it.
And it makes you wonder. What I will say is that what I wonder about is it's been blamed on the coach. And at a certain point, you wonder, yes, Aaron Boone has made some questionable coaching decisions. We can dissect those. We can dissect, is he as good a quote-unquote communicator as everyone says he is?
But stop being a damn communicator and start managing the game
properly.
But
it makes you wonder, is it just this core? That's sort of what I felt about the mid-2000s Mets. They had a lot of talent, but there was just something about that core where they just didn't have it. They just, when the games were there, they just didn't have it. Now, this is not relevant for right now because it's April, but it is something we're foreshadowing and definitely we'll need to keep an eye on.
Oh, boy. It's going to be those dog days of summer, and it's not even May yet. That's not a good sign, folks. We're going to move right now into something that will hopefully cause me fewer heart palpitations and maybe get Daniel off his high horse. And that is the return of our much-acclaimed hypothetical rules segment from last week. So, in case you missed it, we either find a rule that is being talked about, or we come up with a proposition of our own, and then we will debate the merits of it. So, for those of you who subscribe to The Athletic, you probably read Jason Starks' article the other day. If you did not, I highly suggest you subscribe. I believe there's a promo code going on right now where you can get it for $1 a month. So, for $12 a year, that is a terrific thing with the amount of just top-flight writers that The Athletic has. And, you know, The Athletic, if any of you are listening out there, you really should consider sponsoring us for the plug that we're giving right now. But Jason Stark, who is a Baseball Hall of Fame writer, has come up with the findings of how the Atlantic League and Major League Baseball are once again in cahoots. The Atlantic League, for those of you who don't know, is a semi-pro league. And they are very fond of experimenting with the rules of the game, which is one thing that Commissioner Rob Manfred of Major League Baseball has been doing since the moment he took over for Bud Selig. So we have two rules this week that we're going to discuss that they are looking at implementing in the Atlantic League, and if it works well there, potentially putting into Major League Baseball. And boy, I hope one of them doesn't. The other one is a bit more interesting. So let's start with the one that I'm against, and that is moving the pitching mound back a whole 12 inches, from 60 feet 6 inches to 61 feet 6 inches. And for those of you who don't know, the distance of the pitching mound has not been changed in over 120 years. That's right. Since the late 1800s, the pitching mound has been 60 feet 6 inches. Dan, I get that they want to do this in the name of lowering strikeouts. I don't think that's going to work in this situation.
It will work in lowering strikeouts. That is actually true, as the article discussed, and as simple common sense discussed. If you throw a 93-mile-an-hour fastball, it's no longer a 93-mile-an-hour fastball from 61 feet. That foot makes a difference. But my concern is how this changes pitching mechanics. Now, I know the article and the Atlantic League and the MLB discuss, well, it shouldn't really change pitching mechanics. It's, you know, a lot of pitchers, they use more of a windup anyways. They end up pitching further far back. It's not going to affect it. We already have more pitcher injuries than at any other time in history. And you're just going to experiment by moving the mound back a foot? That could cause real problems. And I get trying to bring excitement back into the game. I get trying to reduce the walks. And I get that in 1969, famously, after the year of the pitcher in 1968 and after Bob Gibson had the most incredible season in the history of baseball.
Well, that's a subjective statement right there.
It's not that subjective. He had a 1.12 ERA. We could go through the stats all day.
Really, 40 wins in a year isn't more
than a 1.12 ERA. Whatever, they're both unbelievable accomplishments. But the point is that next year they obviously changed a lot of the rules. They moved the pitching mound down.
Well, the height of the mound, the physical mound did not move.
Of course, but the point is that is what they were going for with this rule. I just don't think this is the way to do it. I think it'll screw up pitching mechanics. I think it's it's not going to do as much. The bigger thing is that the sabermetrics are encouraging the walks more. I like seeing strikeouts. I just don't like that we're seeing so many of them all the time, and that's all we're getting. I think there's other ways to do it.
Well, I'm not so worried about the pitching mechanics, because moving it back 1 foot again with the windups and everything, that's going to be negligible. I think the decrease in velocity, I think the more movement on the pitches, which could cause a lot more warps, which could cause a lot more stress on the pitcher, which could then lead to more injury and fewer innings out of starters and everything. I think that would be an issue. But in the name of offense on it, you already have the three true outcomes of the strikeout, the walk, and the home run. If hitters feel, in this era of launch angle and exit velocity, if they already feel, you know what, let's go ahead and sit on this pitch because we don't have to gear up for 93 anymore. We're going to gear up for 91. We're going to continue to swing from the heels. That's still going to be an issue, and they're still going to either strike out, walk, or hit a home run. And so that's not going to solve it. You need hitters to change their approach. They need to stop focusing on the launch angle and start focusing on beating the shifts. They need to hit the ball the other way. Hit the ball on a line. What's the old adage in baseball? That just because you look up the middle doesn't mean you won't hit a home run? Guess what? There are plenty of times where if you're just looking for a single, you're going to hit a home run anyway. That's how strong these guys are. So the whole home run or bust aspect is what needs to be changed. Not the, well, the pitcher needs to be moved back in order to give the hitters a better chance. So the hitters are not going to change their approach.
And that is the ultimate issue with this rule. And maybe even the next rule is that you can change a lot of the rules. They've even talked about banning shifts as a possibility. That's also been discussed. Will that, in the end, do it? I don't think so. I think that you tend to be right, that maybe these will have negligible effects, but ultimately...
Whoa, wait, ladies and gentlemen, I think I just had a stroke. Dan just said I was right?
I did.
Someone get that in recording and send that to us ASAP, please.
Matt, you have to be right once in a while. It's a rare occurrence, but I give you...
Whoa, a lot more than one rare occurrence over here.
But yeah, this mindset is what's happening. I mean, and it's a hard fix. It's hard to bring back something like the hit and run. It's not going to happen through rule changes.
No, it won't. And speaking of the hit and run and more strategic aspects, that brings us to our second rule that the Atlantic League and Major League Baseball are experimenting with. And they're calling it the double hook DH rule. What does that mean? It means that normally, at least in the American League here in Major League Baseball, but in the Atlantic League, this would be for all teams, they would have the universal DH, and that sounds all fine and dandy. It's an extra job for a semi-pro guy, an extra hitter in the lineup, terrific. But hold on a sec, folks. That DH is tied to your pitcher. When the starting pitcher leaves the game, your designated hitter leaves the lineup. Yes, you can move the designated hitter into the field if they're a capable fielder and take the fielder who was originally in that position and remove them from the game. Absolutely. And that's essentially what a double switch is. And we already see that in Major League Baseball. It puts an emphasis on you're going to need a lot better pinch hitters. You're going to need more pinch hitters. And you're going to need a bigger bench, meaning fewer pitchers being carried on your staff, which just completely changes the way that teams are constructed right now, which means that general managers are going to have to go back to the drawing board.
This rule, I don't know that it'll solve the issues in baseball, and it is being discussed because it adds a strategic element and a strategic incentive to keep your starters in. I don't know if it would fully do that, but I actually like this rule. I am one who doesn't want the DH to come in fully. I actually think that having the pitcher and having that aspect where there's pinch hitting adds an exciting strategic element. But I get the players union and the pitcher side of it of saying, look, there's a high risk when pitchers have to run the bases, and that's not something that we're interested in doing. We want the DH. So I get both sides of it. This is actually a compromise because you are having a DH for the starting pitching, and it also maintains that strategic incentive. Do you have more versatile DHs because you want somebody that you can bring into the game afterwards? Do you do more pinch hitting? Do you change the way that your bench is configured? Do you leave starters in sometimes because you know that you're going to lose that DH spot in the bottom of the inning if you take them out? There's a lot of intrigue here. So I'm actually a pretty big fan of this idea, or seeing how it works out at least. That's what I'm saying.
You might be a big fan. I haven't quite made up my mind on it yet. It's definitely an intriguing rule. Getting to your point of the Players Association and the pitchers not being fond of pitchers having a hit afterwards if you don't have a pinch hitter available for them, I have to think that owners and general managers aren't going to be too thrilled with that either, just because they spend so much money on these pitchers and they want to bubble wrap them as much as possible to protect their investments. You really think that they want to expose their pitchers to even more potential injury with running the bases? And you know, a lot of owners and a lot of general managers want to cut back on their spending. They're going to have to spend more money for more pinch hitters. You might need to expand the roster size even more, and they're not opening the purse strings for that.
But pinch hitting is a really interesting, again, it is interesting for the fans. And actually, for the
paging Matt Stairs, it's time to come out of retirement.
I used to love those guys, honestly. Like, even remember Matt Franco, and he was the one for the Mets in the late 90s. Lenny Harris was a name that comes to mind, and I like those guys. It's like you have a role. You have Joe McEwing back in the days. Or Damon Easley a little bit more recently. It's an interesting aspect of the game, and I think having that added back into it, it's a cool idea.
It definitely will be an interesting one, as I've said. I don't know that I'm going to go as far as my co-host to say it's going to be a cool idea, but it's something nonetheless that it bears watching. We've already seen that the Atlantic League experimented with the runner at second base to start extra innings, the minimum three batter rule for relievers, the pitch clocks. We've already seen all those experimented, and lo and behold, they've been implemented in Major League Baseball. So go out if this summer, if you know an Atlantic League team nearby, you might want to go check them out to get used to what might be the new normal in a couple years from now. I hope I'm wrong, at least on one of the rules. The other rule, I'm willing to be a little bit more, keep a wait-and-see approach.
And it's telling that the 61 feet, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not for the full season.
It's just the second half of the season.
It's just they're trying it. So that is telling that they're less sure. They're even less sure about it. They're even less confident in that rule than the double hook DH rule, which they are having for the whole season. So they're clearly more sure about it, at least to a degree.
At this rate, it almost feels like Rob Manfred is just grasping for straws to change the game of baseball because he doesn't like the way the game is played. It really gives off that feel. I can get some of the rules. You need to speed up the game because today's audiences don't want to tune in for a four-hour game. I get that. But the amount of games that go 4 hours, 5 hours, to be honest, are some of the more exciting ones, and they're very, very rare. I mean, unless they're Yankee Red Sox, they're very, very rare games that they go that long. And it generally means that the game's in the 15th or 16th inning, and those are the games that you went to bed because you have an early day at work the next day, you wake up in the middle of the night to go use the bathroom, you looked at the clock, and your TV is on because you sleep with the TV on in the background, and you notice the game is still on in the 16th inning, and you're just like, oh, let me stay awake to watch this. And that's the exciting part of baseball, and Rob Manfred's trying to do away with it.
And even in terms of the pitching, and obviously there's a lot of controversy about strikeouts and even moving back the pitching mounds, I found it very exciting that all these no-hitters are happening, right? I think it's good for the sport. So just blindly wanting to cut certain parts of the game, wanting to decrease velocity, it has its problems. It really has its problems.
Look, we're going to be at the bicentennial. Yes, the bicentennial of professional baseball in this country in less than two decades' time. It clearly has worked for most of that time. I'll say it's probably worked for 75% of that time, 80%. Because the first couple decades, it was very sporadic. They had a lot of different rule changes trying to figure out what would work, what didn't work. It worked for most of the time. So why are you trying to change it now? There were no issues that needed to be taken out. You can tweak things. But you don't need to overhaul the entire sport. That's how you lose people.
And it'll be interesting to see. Because really, as you've said, these rules, they are somewhat more likely to go into play. Because the Atlantic League, that's where they try. It's like their laboratory. That's a good way to describe it. It's like baseball's laboratory. So in the next couple of years, you could see all this come into play.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to be something, again, as we've said, to keep an eye on. We are going to move into our much-acclaimed fan call-in segment. And if there's any sponsors out there who would like to sponsor the fan call-in segment to give it a much better name, the phone lines are open for you. In the meantime, we're going to be bringing in Jeremy from Briarwood, who is going to give us his sports hot take. So let's get Jeremy on the line. Hey, Jeremy, it's Matt and Dan from Outside the Studio. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on.
It's our pleasure. So, Jeremy, what's this sports hot take of yours?
Well, you know, listening in on your guys' conversation about the Mets this year and how they're doing so far through the first, what is it, eight games? And
it's
pretty sad how many cancellations and postponements they've had. And it's just, you can't foresee what Mother Nature will do.
Right. Well, look, Mother Nature. That's why they have off days scheduled into the schedule in April, because
yeah.
Major League Baseball knows that it's very fickle, the weather in this first month.
Yeah, I mean it's April, and you're gonna have the summer days where you know you're gonna have less snow in the forecast like they do today, and you're gonna have more doubleheaders. You're gonna have all these players that are ready to go. They've been playing every day. But for the Mets, they haven't played every day, and they're somehow in first place. So they can only get better from here when they play every day.
Yeah, I think there's something to that, Jeremy, is that once they play every day, they'll be well-rested. They're going to get into a rhythm. So maybe some of these bats that aren't warm, they'll start to warm up a little bit as the team plays more.
And that's the thing. Some people are very streaky, you know, and as you were talking about McNeil and Alonso, they'll get there. You can't expect amazing performances every single day out of these players. They're not a Mike Trout. They're not a, you know, any star player, but they're good. They'll get there. Just got to be positive.
Well,
you know?
Thank you, Jeremy, so much for sharing that. And thank you so much for being a listener. And we hope that you continue to do so, and we'll hopefully have you back on the air as a caller again soon.
Sounds good. Thank you guys so much.
You're welcome. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are almost at that time of the show again, that time when we almost have to say goodbye. There's one thing that I do want to mention, though, and I haven't received anyone's recordings yet of us hearing Dan say that I was right about something. So, Dan, I'd like to, you've had, what, probably about 10, 15 minutes to think things over. Care to take back that statement about me not being right all that often?
Matt, let's look at the records, okay? Neither of us have been right that often. This is what we need to work on with this show. Walt has been streaky. Walt has been hot. He's, you know, he got Houston going to the Final Four. His Final Four was good. He won 700. You and I, we need to go back to the drawing board a little bit. We need to make some changes because
I'm not talking about the predictions part of being right. I'm talking about the knowing what you're talking about. Forget the predictions. Predictions can go out the window.
Predictions are very fickle, Matt. But in terms of being right, it's more of a feeling that I get. It's a feeling that I get where I say, "Oh, Matt, did what he was saying make sense? Is he?"
I mean, I certainly make a lot more sense than you do half the time,
Matt. I would have to say that our listeners would not agree with that. We will have a fan vote on that. We'll have a fan vote on. Does Daniel make more sense? Does Daniel make more cogent points? Or does Matt and his yelling and, you know, I'm a calm guy.
This is Sports Talk Radio over here.
I'm a calm guy.
You've got to bring some personality and pizzazz to this.
I'm very reasonable. Matt, you're very flashy. I get your type. And I think, you know, we're going to do a poll this week on social media, fans. We're going to see who is more right, who has a more reasonable outlook on life.
Whoa. What does any of this have to do with a reasonable outlook on life? We're talking professional sports right here. We're not talking about life events.
Matt, sports is a reflection of life. Okay.
So when did you become Socrates over here?
So when last week we were discussing the Elam rule, which you very much didn't like, and we're very concerned about the unintended consequences, and we're also very concerned about the networks, that was your outlook on life. You were more concerned about the networks than about the fans. See, sports is just an allegory. Sports is just a metaphor for what is out there in the world. It's like Plato's allegory of the cave.
All right, I wasn't aware that I was speaking to the ghost of Plato over here. Care to talk to me more about, let's see, probably been about 1,000 years that you've been dead ghost over here. So, anything you'd like to tell us that we're looking forward to in the afterlife?
Sports is, sports is what we're here for. And anybody who has listened to the show the last couple weeks, they'll realize that that Plato would love our show as well. He would think that it's very reasonable, and he would also think, Matt, that you've been losing your cool a little bit too much.
All right. Well, on that note, ladies and gentlemen, that's all the time we have for you today. We might have a new co-host next week. We'll see. If you missed our live show today, just remember you can always catch the recordings on thenewyorkextra.com, Spotify, Podomatic, iTunes, and Apple Podcasts, and SoundCloud. So please tune back in next Friday, April 23rd at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for more Hot and Cold Takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner. To my left at the moment is co-host Daniel Green saying thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed our theme song written by Jessica Page DeMary, please visit her website, jzcompositions.com, for her full works. And we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.
Cast Network, the streaming future of sports talk radio. Listen to us round the clock on the net over 365sportscast.com. On your phone with the 365 Sportscast app,